From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Zelda Gilroy, she was brainy and assertive, but all she really wanted to do was marry Dobie Gillis. Sheila James Kuhl is the actress who played Zelda. Her acting career ended because of rumors she was a lesbian. Now she's a feminist lawyer who runs the California Women's Law Center. We'll meet her on today's Fresh Air. Also, what's the physiological difference between singing jazz and singing opera? We'll get a demonstration from Judy Nemac. She gave up opera for jazz, studied with saxophonist Warren Marsh, and as you'll hear, she does wonderful things with jazz and pop standards. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews the Great Performances 20th Anniversary Special on PBS. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Iraq's UN ambassador said today that an American who was seized by Iraqi security police is safe and in good health. The man was identified as Chad Hall, a munitions expert working for a firm that has a contract to clear away ammunition and explosives left in Kuwait after the Iraqi occupation. A senior State Department official said that Hall was clearly on Kuwaiti territory when he was seized by the Iraqis. Angola's National Election Council has delayed announcing the results of last week's multi-party elections. Those results had been expected today. NPR's Suni Khalid reports from Angola's capital, Luanda.
United Nations Special Representative Margaret Anstey met today with former rebel leader Jonas Savimbi at Angola's provincial capital of Huambo. Anstey is trying to persuade Savimbi to accept the results of last week's democratic elections and the return of former rebel troops to Angola's new army. According to the last election results, Savimbi trails President José Eduardo dos Santos in presidential balloting. But if dos Santos fails to win 50% of the vote, he must face Savimbi in a runoff election. However, Savimbi is charging mass electoral fraud, and he has threatened to renew Angola's 16-year civil war if the election results are announced. Meanwhile, the National Election Council, the UN's Angola Verification Mission, and the Joint Political Military Council have established four committees to look into alleged electoral irregularities. I'm Suni Khalid in Luanda, Angola.
President Bush campaigned today in Ohio, a battleground state where he's trailing Bill Clinton in one of the public opinion polls 48-38%. In Cincinnati, he picked up the endorsement of the Fraternal Order of Police. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The president told the police organization that his opponent, Bill Clinton, was a big government, tax and spend, coddle the criminal man. The 240,000-member Fraternal Order of Police is the largest law enforcement organization in the country. It endorsed Bush in 1988. This year, crime has played a much smaller role in the presidential campaign, taking a back seat to voters' concerns about the economy and jobs. And Bill Clinton has stressed his own crime-fighting credentials. Recently, he picked up the endorsement of the International Brotherhood of Police Officers in Atlanta, and he's been running ads reminding voters of his support for the death penalty and his plan to put 100,000 more police officers on the streets. In Ohio, I'm Mara Liasson.
There were two more explosions in London this evening. The blasts were believed to be caused by car bombs, one of which was planted in front of a club for former members of the armed services. A second blast occurred outside a London subway station. The London Fire Brigade had no immediate information on the extent of casualties or damage. The Dow Jones Industrials lost 39 points today to close at 3,136. This is NPR. The Senate Intelligence Committee is holding secret hearings to determine whether the Justice Department conspired with the CIA to conceal information about illegal loans to Iraq. Committee Chairman David Boren said the investigation is focusing on CIA letters that were sent last month to the Justice Department and the U.S. Attorney in Atlanta. Boren convened the hearings unexpectedly before the Senate adjourned for the year. Justice Department officials appeared as witnesses today. Texaco officials still haven't determined what caused last night's explosion and fire at the company's oil refinery near Los Angeles. The company's refinery chief has toured the surrounding community and has offered to pay any damages caused by the blast. Paul Gomez reports.
The president of Texaco's oil refinery division says firefighters are still supervising the residual flames from last night's explosion. Donald Schmoody says it's premature to speculate on what caused the blast and said it may be a few days before investigators have answers. Schmoody spent most of the afternoon surveying damaged areas near the refinery. The Wilmington, California plant will remain closed for about a week. Texaco estimates the company will lose close to 50,000 barrels of oil production a day due to the closure. Employees will remain on the job despite the shutdown. For National Public Radio, I'm Paul Gomez in Los Angeles.
The Federal Aviation Administration has ordered U.S. air carriers to inspect the engine mounting pins on early models of the Boeing 747 jumbo jet. There's speculation that last weekend's crash of an El Al cargo jet in Amsterdam may be linked to defective mounting pins. Before the Israeli 747 crashed into an apartment complex, the pilot had reported an engine fire and the plane dropped at least one engine. The FAA's order gives the force of law to a Boeing service bulletin that was issued on Monday. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Dobie, wants a gal that's dreamy. Dobie, wants a gal that's dreamy. Dobie, wants a gal to call his own. Is she blonde? Is she tall? Is she dark? Is she small? Is she any kind of dreamer at all?
Of the many loves of Dobie Gillis, the girl who loved him the most and the longest was Zelda Gilroy. She was brainy and aggressive, but she wasn't quite the dreamboat Dobie was looking for. The actress who played Zelda doesn't watch the Dobie reruns on Nick at Night. She's too busy with her work as a woman's rights lawyer. My guest is actress-turned-activist Sheila James Kuhl. Her acting career ended shortly after the Dobie Gillis show. Now she believes no one wanted to hire her because of rumors she was a lesbian. The rumors were true. When the work stopped, she went back to school, became a feminist, studied law, and put the two together. Her 8-page resume is very impressive. She now directs the California Women's Law Center. She's taught classes on gender and the law at several universities. She was president of the Women Lawyers Association of Los Angeles and was the second woman in the history of Harvard Law School to win the moot court competition. On page 3 of her resume, under the heading Other Employment, she lists actress, Dobie Gillis series, 1959 to 1963.
Every decade, I sort of look back on my life, and I had my 50th birthday last year, and I see things much more contextually. It seems like a continuum to me, and the acting, I did it for 15 years. You don't want to lose 15 years of your life, even if it was from the age of 9 to 24, which people don't normally put on their resume. But it's all part of, I think, my ability to talk and to feel comfortable in a huge variety of places. I mean, I grew up working class, but as soon as I started acting as a kid, I did a TV series called Trouble with Father, which was the first film television series. And all of a sudden, you know, they were taking me to lunch at the Brown Derby, and I'd never eaten anywhere but the counter at Thrifty's drugstore. So it lent a great deal to my life, and I like to see it on the resume. It's sort of fun.
So how old were you when you got the part?
18.
And how did you like the character?
I loved her. I still think of her as sort of my little sister. It's interesting because once the women's movements sort of came to blossom in the 70s, I started getting a lot of letters from women who were coming to consciousness as feminists telling me that they now remembered Zelda very fondly because she was the only girl on television in all those times in the early 60s who had a brain. I mean, she not only had a brain, but she was smarter than everyone in the world, who was aggressive, who knew what she wanted, went and got it. She was going to go to medical school. She, of course, on the other hand, she really thought it was Dobie who ought to be president of the United States, and her main aspiration was to marry him. And interestingly enough, in the reunion movies, in the first reunion movie, Zelda was in law school. In the second reunion movie, she was working in the grocery store married to Dobie. So it's just a difference, I think, between the late 70s and late 80s, just in terms of how the movie was written. And it's sort of relationship history that kind of reflects culture, I think.
Do you have a favorite Dobie episode?
I do. It was called Dobie, Dobie, Who's Got the Dobie? And it was really about Zelda being totally heartsick because Dobie won't have anything to do with her, which, of course, was the theme of their entire relationship. And he was chasing another woman. And at some point, Zelda places herself in the soda shop within full view of Dobie and this new woman. And she's wearing widow's attire, you know, black from head to foot with a veil over her face. And she's sobbing uncontrollably at this table. And Dobie comes over and he says, Zelda, you know, you're breaking my heart. You're ruining my romance. I need you to do something for me. And if you really, really love me, you will. And Zelda says, anything, Poopsie, I'll do anything for you. And he says, smile. And she says, smile? He says, smile. So I started smiling and he keeps saying, wider, wider, wider. And finally she's got this huge grin that goes from ear to ear, which is not in her eyes. You know what I mean? This hideous grin. And she says, I'm cracking my face. And he says, now laugh. And so she starts laughing. And I built up this maniacal laugh that went for almost a minute and a half that just built up to, you know, this peak. And then she pulls out a bottle of poison and drinks it. And the show itself is, it's, I don't know, it has wonderful feeling to it. And I don't know, it's my favorite. It was, I think it was the best work I ever did.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Sheila James Kuehl. You probably know her as the actress who played Zelda Gilroy on the Dobie Gillis series. She has since become a feminist activist, a lawyer. She now heads the Southern California Women's Law Center. It's very difficult for young people to grow up on camera, which you did. But it might have been especially difficult to grow up on camera and start realizing, maybe I'm a lesbian, because this was at a period when it was pretty socially unacceptable. There wasn't much of a gay rights movement, not much in terms of support. So did you start going through this kind of inner questioning in front of in the period when you were in front of the camera?
Terry, you're the mistress of understatement. You say there wasn't much of a movement, and it was sort of like not too cool to be queer. Yes, it was very, like, if you count losing your career, losing your family, losing the people in your religion, being fired from whatever you're doing, yeah, it was totally uncool.
Did you lose all that?
Yeah. I don't miss any of that, actually. It's the closet was just awful. I'll tell you, it was totally frightening. It was terrifying. First of all, I had no context in which to put the fact that I was falling in love with a woman. I thought it was so bizarre and so strange and so unnatural, and yet it felt so right that I simply kept the relationship, of course, extremely, extremely, extremely secret from my parents, from everybody, never told a friend, I mean, for years. And in the third year that we were doing Dobie, Zelda was getting a lot of fan mail, and Max Schulman and everyone loved her character. So Max wrote a pilot, a spin-off pilot, in which I would star, that featured Zelda as the lead character. And we made the pilot for the series, and CBS was extremely high on the series. And all of a sudden, the pilot just dropped like a stone, and nobody talked about it anymore. And finally, the director had the courage and compassion, I think, to take me aside and ask if we could go for a walk, and told me that there was this rumor that, that I was, not straight, essentially. And it was just a rumor, and no one knew where it came from, but it was enough to get CBS to completely scotch the pilot, and I only did 4 shows the next year in Dobie, and that was it. So the homophobia in the industry, which of course only reflects how strong it is outside the industry, has devastated, I think, some careers. And to tell you the truth, I never even thought about it that much myself. I mean, people would say, why did you leave show business? And I would make some, weak joke about how, you don't leave show business. The phone just stops ringing. And that's what happened to me. And but it was homophobia.
What word did the... who'd you say it was, the director who took you aside?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
What word did he use for lesbian when he was talking with you? Do you remember?
Well, I think that he said, they think you're just too butch. Which, of course, is a great joke now, I think.
Well, I'm sure the irony wasn't lost on you that, here you were in love with a woman and playing on TV this woman who is just addicted to Dobie Gillis.
Well, it may seem funny now, but I don't see it really... The more important, interesting thing to me, I think, was the fact that she was the strongest female character on television.
Mm-hmm.
She was capable and competent and smart, but her whole idea was she wanted to marry him and have him be successful. And what Max, I think, realized was this is not what Dobie wanted either. He wanted to be a poet. He didn't care about money. He didn't care about success. And so everybody was after something that was totally wrong for their lives in a way, which made them all losers.
When the director took you aside and told you that there was a rumor that you were a lesbian and you figured out this was really going to hurt your career, was anyone explicit with you about what the studio's fears were?
No. Oh, no. Everyone was very embarrassed. It's like people talking to their kids about sex. I mean, you just don't talk about it. That was it. What I told you is what he told me. And there was like this piece of ice that came into my heart. I didn't know what it would mean. I was simply afraid that I would be found out. I couldn't even imagine it would affect my career. You don't think about it. I mean, I was 20 years old, okay? I didn't think, oh, how awful, I won't work again.
Was, do you know if anybody, like, gossiped about you on the set or was overtly malicious? And of course, it was malicious to kind of basically throw you out of the industry, but I mean just on a more...
No, I know that no one did.
Uh-huh.
Dwayne didn't know. Bob Denver didn't know. It was... a total secret. I mean, no one even thought about it very much in those days.
Did you have anyone you could talk to about this?
No one. Not one person.
Not even your lover?
Well, I mean, it was not clear to me what effect it was going to have. I knew that the pilot didn't sell, but I'm telling you, it's now... so many years later, and it's the first time I've ever started even to come to grips with the fact that my acting career probably stopped in great part because of this rumor. But I never thought about it then. We didn't have the word homophobia. I didn't know there was a gay or lesbian community. I didn't know there was anybody like me. And I simply put it out of my consciousness. And I really believed, I think, for a long time. Because there were other actors who, you know, the series stops and they didn't work. I think I believe that it was simply sort of luck of the draw, and sometimes you work and sometimes you don't, and now it was over. And, of course, as it turns out, it was an enormously good thing for my life that I stopped acting, because over the course of the 70s, the women's movement reached out and grabbed me. I went to law school, and now I love what I do, much more than I ever loved acting, which was a lot.
After the Dobie Gillis series, you were in another series called Broadside that was like a female version of McHale's Navy.
Right.
Was being a lesbian an issue in getting that series? I mean, they didn't know about the rumor.
I don't think so.
Yeah. No. Dick Sargent was in that series, too. And
yes, he was.
And he has since come out. As a matter of fact, you came out on TV together. So did you know... that he was gay, and did he know that you were a lesbian when you were working together?
After the show, we came, over the course of the year that we did Broadside, we met each other's lovers, and over time afterward would have dinner together. I knew his lover, Frank, just about up until the time Frank died, I think. And, you know, these were both very long-term relationships. My generation got married and was essentially monogamous, in the women's community, at least. And they, you know, we would have dinner, and we knew about it.
You said before that, you know, through coming out, you lost your family and your religion.
No. I said that you could. You personally didn't. No. Actually, but I didn't come out to my parents for 20 years after that.
It's a long time.
A long time. And, of course, my mother, bless her heart, looked at me with this sort of sad, understanding, wise look and said, "Oh, honey, we always knew you liked girls better."
Really?
Yeah.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Sheila James Kuehl, who starred as Zelda Gilroy in Dobie Gillis and for years has been an activist feminist lawyer and now heads a women's law center in Southern California. And we're talking about her life. So we'll be back after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Sheila James Kuehl is my guest. When your acting career was ended, were you angry or disappointed? What did you feel at the time?
I think I was just mostly really sad and really scared about how I was going to earn my living. I didn't feel I had any skills that would help me earn a living. I didn't even know how smart I was. And I went back to UCLA, which is where I had graduated while I was working on Dobie in the year after, and just begged them basically for a job. I had been in the student government and loved, we weren't activists yet in that generation, but I loved that stuff, and was fortunate enough to be hired working with students at UCLA, which is what eventually led to my going to law school.
How do you think you ended up becoming an activist as opposed to being a kind of bitter, injured person? You know what I mean? A lot of people who have
the kind
of experience...
You don't think I'm a bitter, injured person, huh?
No, a lot of people who have the kind of experience you had would perhaps never recover from it.
I don't know. I think some kind of genetic makeup that goes to humor. I'm not really sure. Every time something happens, it's devastating. I feel absolutely devastated, but it also sort of strikes me funny in a way. The sort of cosmic joke. I don't know whether I'm so evolved or what, but I guess the probably the best answer to your question is that my parents made me feel very secure, and a lot of people's parents don't. They just loved the hell out of me, and they never actually made me feel insecure by, you know, that they were critical or they thought I was going to get a swelled head. It was just fine with them if I got a swelled head when I was a kid. They thought I was terrific. And it made me feel growing up as though the most important place in my universe for confidence was really inside myself. And it really helps you bounce back from a lot of stuff.
Tell me how you started becoming involved with feminist issues and started to see yourself as a feminist.
Well, in the 70s, I was working, in the early 70s, when I went to work at UCLA, I was working in an office that advises student organizations, and I was given to advise the SDS, the Progressive Labor Party, the Women's Liberation Front, the Black Student Union, and the fledgling Chicano students, because there were no people of color in my office, of course, and they didn't want very much advice, but they started sort of rolling around to my apartment late at night just to talk strategy. You know, what can I do and not get arrested? And then I would say half the point is to get arrested. And we started getting in touch in the office and in other student services offices with the fact that women students were not really getting all the services they need. Housing, psychological, medical, whatever the non-academic services were. So we called a meeting, those of us who were sort of in middle management in these student services, to talk about what women might need in these services. And it was exactly the same day as the day that I found out that I had not gotten a promotion in my office and that a man who was hired later than I was promoted instead. And I basically got in touch with the fact that I really felt screwed over by not getting this promotion and that I was starting to see in this, what Ms. used to call a click, I had a click. And the click was, I didn't get this promotion because I'm a woman. And I found out later that the man who denied my promotion had said, she's just too aggressive, which, of course, he did not say about the man that got the promotion. And at that point, I got really mad. And when I get mad, I get going. I have a lot of energy. So I organized a group of women to open a women's resource center at UCLA, and I'm proud to say I am the mother of the women's resource center there. And we opened it against the chancellor's orders. I almost got fired, but we did it. And we had the first Women's Week, I think it was 20 years ago now. It was a very exciting time, and before I knew it, I was a feminist.
Were you out then?
No, I was not out. As a matter of fact, I was going through a straight phase at that time.
Uh-huh.
I don't mean this in any funny way, but since my first lover of my whole life was a woman and it was a long-term relationship, I was curious. And I didn't sleep with any men until I was, 29 or 30. And then I decided, well, maybe I have to see what this is all about. And so I slept with a whole bunch of them. All my friends, though, no strangers, okay? And it was a wonderful time in my life.
Now, in your legal work, you've worked a lot with issues of domestic abuse, sex discrimination, reproductive rights. Can you tell us about an action or a legal decision that you were involved with that you feel had the most impact on women or that you feel most proud of?
Well, it depends on what you mean by involved with, because so much of the work that women do in the law is really collaborative and coalition work, especially at the policy level. 2 years ago in California, after 7 years of work, a bill that I had worked personally on for 7 years, simply to require judges to take domestic violence into account in custody decisions, was finally passed. It had enormous opposition, which, of course, should make us understand how important it is for men to get away with violence in their relationship and still to be considered good fathers. But we overcame the opposition, and I'm very proud of that because I think that was good law center and good personal work.
Do you ever have the urge to act anymore?
Well, sometimes I do, mostly when I wonder how I'm going to pay the house insurance, you know, things like that. But then every 10 years we've done a reunion movie, and both times we've done them, it has come back to me very strongly that I'm really, really, really glad that I'm doing what I'm doing now and not that.
Why?
Well, you get up at 5:30 in the morning, you go into makeup at 6 o'clock in a place with no windows, put on the makeup, go to the set, work in a place with no windows and no phone that, you know, I mean, there's a phone, but you can't spend all day on the phone like I do, talking to people who are doing incredibly interesting and important work. You do some scenes with the effect that you're probably going to make some people laugh down the line. You don't choose the people that you're with. They're people who were cast, and they're nice enough, but, you know, they're not necessarily political or anything. You're exhausted. You go home. You sleep. You get up, and you start over. It's essentially meaningless. From the activist point of view. You know, I mean, I think Candace Bergen is doing a great job of bringing a feminist character to the, you know, to America. Designing Women does a great job in bringing up the issues and the shows they do. I think it's real important work. But I think the most that activist actresses and actors do, really, is to recognize that it's their responsibility to use their celebrity in order to anoint a cause and just show up. But you don't find any of them being the theorists or strategists for the movement, etc. They're essentially their celebrity. They show up.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's not enough for me anymore.
Do you think there's going to ever be a made-for-TV movie about your life?
Sure. But not until after I am elected to the state assembly and maybe the state senate and maybe the Congress.
Are you going to try to run?
Oh, yeah. I'm going to run for the state assembly as soon as the seat. I filed to run this year, but a good friend of women and gays and lesbians who was already in the assembly didn't have a district anymore because, you know, our state's been totally redistricted like so many have. And he moved into my district, and I didn't want to run against him. So I essentially said, okay, I'll wait. We have, as the rest of the world probably knows, term limits here in California. So I said, I'll wait, and I'm running as soon as you're not. So I will. And then maybe they'll make a movie about me. But only if I win, I'm sure.
Right, right, right. Well, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Terry. It's been a pleasure for me, too.
Sheila James Kuehl directs the California Women's Law Center. And you can see her as Zelda Gilroy on the Dobie Gillis reruns on Nick at Night. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
Judy Nemac started out singing opera, but switched to jazz. Barbara Streisand without the hysterics is how she was recently described in The Village Voice. Coming up, we'll hear what she does with Come Rain or Come Shine, and we'll get a lesson in improvisation. It's the 20th anniversary of the TV series Great Performances. To mark the date, PBS has put together a special edition of the show, airing tonight. TV critic David Bianculli has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In New York City, the UN Security Council has approved a ban on all military flights over Bosnia. This measure is intended to stop Serbian air attacks on civilian targets in the region. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
The resolution was approved by a vote of 14-0, with China abstaining. The measure orders UN peacekeeping troops to be stationed at Bosnian airfields to monitor the skies. The resolution contains no enforcement provisions, but Western officials say they are ready to consider using force if the ban is violated. The ban applies to all military flights, but it is targeted implicitly at Serbian forces. Serbs have some 40 warplanes left over from the Yugoslavian Air Force and have reportedly been using them to attack non-Serbian neighborhoods. Today's resolution marks the first time the Security Council has approved a so-called no-fly zone over a country, although three permanent Security Council members, France, Britain, and the U.S., imposed a ban over southern Iraq in late August to protect dissident Shiites. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
Iraq's ambassador to the UN says that an American seized by Iraqi security forces is safe and in good health, and he hopes this does not escalate into a major crisis. Barry Schweid reports from the State Department that diplomatic efforts are underway to get the man back.
The incident could heat up the Persian Gulf again, but so far the Bush administration is trying to avoid a confrontation, demanding that the American, identified by the UN as Chad Hall, be freed and otherwise working through Polish and UN diplomats. The U.S. and Iraq, which confirmed its holding Hall, have been at odds time and again over Iraq's periodic refusal to permit UN inspectors access to weapons facilities. Customarily, Iraq backs down, and that's clearly the hope of the State Department in the case of Hall, who apparently was detained on the Kuwaiti side of the border, supervising Pakistanis who dismantle Iraqi weapons. There's a chance the incident could be serious, though, since the area, a demilitarized zone, is disputed, and Iraq could be making a point by detaining Hall. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schweid at the State Department.
There have been two more explosions in the London area, this time in North London. It's believed that both explosions were car bombs, and one occurred outside the offices of a War Veterans Association. There have been four earlier explosions this week, and the Irish Republican Army claimed responsibility for the first two. There has been no word as yet on injuries or damage from tonight's explosions. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 39 points to close at 3,136.58 on volume of more than 179 million shares. Declining issues led advances in active trading. This is NPR News. The State Department says that Vietnam's foreign minister has been in Washington to hold talks with top Bush administration officials about the possibility of normal relations between the two nations. A spokesman said the meeting was not announced because it was felt it was better to keep it private for a bit. The Bush administration has linked an exchange of ambassadors to the fullest possible accounting by Vietnam of U.S. servicemen still missing from the Vietnam War. Thousands of Germans gathered on the streets of Bonn and Berlin this evening to mourn the death of former West German Chancellor Willy Brandt. Deidre Berger has more.
After a moment of silence in the German Bundestag, Parliamentary President Rita Süssmuth called the 1971 Nobel Peace Prize winner a great man, whose disputed détente policies in the 1970s changed the world. She termed Brandt a man of peace and understanding through reconciliation and justice. The former Nazi opponent became West Germany's first social democratic chancellor in 1969, resigning 5 years later over an East German spy affair. Chancellor Helmut Kohl said he was grateful to Brandt for his support of unification, President Bush hailed him as a first-class statesman. Former Soviet leader Gorbachev said the Cold War would not have ended without Braun's détente policies. A special state ceremony to honor Braun will be held at the Berlin Reichstag a week from Saturday. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
At a summit meeting, leaders of the states of the former Soviet Union have decided not to form a strong central group with executive powers. Six members of the Commonwealth of Independent States have signed a new agreement creating a single monetary system. The creating of a ruble zone does not necessarily mean that each member state will continue to use the ruble as its currency, only that it will do so in commercial deals with other members. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. If you're interested in finding younger singers who are interpreting pop and jazz classics, let me introduce you to Judy Niemack. As music critic Francis Davis wrote in The Village Voice, Niemack combines the best of both worlds, a cabaret singer's respect for melody as written, and a jazz singer's eagerness to have a go at it. While Davis mentioned two worlds, Niemack is also part of a third. She was trained as an opera singer. Her latest recording, Heart's Desire, is on Stash Records. It features pianist Kenny Barron. Before we meet her, let's hear Come Rain or Come Shine, the opening track of her album.
Gonna love you like nobody's loved you. Come rain or come shine, high as a mountain, deep as a river. Come rain or shine. I guess when you met me, you thought I was just another one of those things. But don't you ever bet me, 'cause I'm gonna be true if you just let me.
Judy Niemack, you have a beautiful voice. You were actually trained as a coloratura. You studied opera.
Yeah, thank you for the compliment. I studied at New England, in New England Conservatory in Boston, after spending a few years in my hometown in Pasadena, California, studying privately.
How far did you get in opera?
Oh, I got to being in student productions in college, you know, that, and then I decided that I love singing and exploring that music, but I didn't want to dedicate my life to it because it was not free enough for me personally. And I was really fascinated with improvisation, and I wanted to use my classical technique but also find out about jazz and improv and really making the music my own.
How much did you know about jazz when you decided you were interested in it?
Oh, well, when I was studying classical, I was also singing jazz at night.
Oh.
And I was in the jazz, I was singing with a jazz big band at New England, and I got reprimanded by the head of the voice department at that time for singing jazz, and he assured me that I would lose my voice if I continued.
Why?
Because jazz was taboo for classical singers. The vocal production is very different, and classical teachers are... this was in 1974, 75. At that time, they were even more adamant about singing only classical and that you would ruin your voice if you sang any pop music at all.
What's the difference between how you use your voice in opera and in pop that would account for hurting your voice?
A lot of times in pop music, singers will push the chest voice register up, and that... I also teach voice, and I find this a lot with people who don't study and who just try to get that belting sound in the pop music. They push the lower register up, and it causes a break in the voice and can damage the voice. But I already had years of technical training, so I knew how to go through all the changes smoothly. I had a real good teacher, and so I'd never had any problems that way.
I'm not sure I know enough technically to follow the
chest voice and hand voice.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so chest voice is like your speaking voice, like ah, and head voice is ah. Chest voice is like ah, and head voices. Ha! So if you take that chest voice, that belting voice, and push it up, it can cause problems. Is that clear?
Yeah, that helps a lot. And does it cause problems in part because it's coming from, it's putting a lot of stress on the throat?
It's not actually the throat, it's the vocal cords.
Right, right, right.
This is pretty technical. But anyway, the vocal cords, you use a different part of the vocal cords, and it can cause strain on them.
So how were you singing when you started singing jazz so that that didn't happen?
Well, I started singing jazz with a real classical voice, which was sounded kind of odd in retrospect. I made a record in 1978 when I was just switching over. And one of the main differences in classical singing is that you use a vibrato. You develop a vibrato that is your habitual sound, and you want to have that all the time. That's your regular tone. And anything else is a variation from, a step away from that. In jazz, you start with a straight tone, and you use a vibrato to add a color. So I started singing jazz, but I had this classical vibrato, and it sounded kind of strange. It sounded more like, you know, musical comedy or theatrical kind of singing. And it took some time for me to get rid of that habit.
It's part of the reason why in opera there's a constant vibrato, so that it projects.
Yeah, it develops a really rich series of overtones that fill out the tone. You want to, you know, have a really large sound so that you can sing over a full orchestra. That's part of the requirements for opera. In jazz, you have a microphone.
When you started singing jazz, did you ever feel like, well, that you should dirty up your voice somehow and get, quote, low down in order to sing it?
Oh, it's been a long process for me of dirtying up my sound and relaxing my inclination toward perfection. And that's one of the things that drew me toward classical music, too. I love the perfection of, you know, really having something perfectly in tune and perfectly in time and the beauty of that. And in jazz, that's great, but never at the expense of emotion and feeling.
Mm-hmm. I guess what I'm wondering is, I think some people who are classically trained when they start to sing jazz think that they have to do this almost caricatured version of getting low down, you know, and put this, I don't know, this like hoarseness into their voice, no matter how kind of clear their voice is. And yeah. I wonder if you went through a period like that of kind of like bending over the other way, you know, to kind of make up for the fact that you had this, you know, kind of beautiful and clear voice.
I never did. I just gradually have tried to come closer to what I think is my unique individual voice without trying to make it anything. I've accepted the fact that I'm white, I'm a trained musician and I adore music, and you know, I'm not just out there singing without knowing what I'm doing, you know, and I'm not ashamed of that.
What was it like before you accepted that you were white?
Well, I used to sort of end up singing with this kind of Billie Holiday accent, you know, that later on I would realize that's not my voice at all, you know. But a lot of people, when they sing jazz, they put on like a black kind of accent because it's part of the tradition.
Uh-huh.
And I just realized that, you know, it's in American music and it's been influenced by all kinds of people. Of course it came from black people and their struggles and, you know, but it also comes from the theater music that was composed by Cole Porter and Irving Berlin and Harold Arlen, and, you know, it's a combination.
My guest is singer Judy Niemack. More in a moment. This is Fresh Air. Singer Judy Niemack is my guest. Before we return to the interview, let's hear something from her latest recording, Heart's Desire. This is Over the Rainbow. She's accompanied by cellist Eric Friedlander. Judy Nemec from her new album, Heart's Desire. Now, I know that you studied singing with the late jazz saxophonist Warren Marsh. What were some of the insights he gave you about singing and improvisation?
Well, Warren didn't know anything about singing, so luckily I had my teacher. But he really grounded me in the tradition of jazz. He started me out learning solos by Louis Armstrong, Lester Young, Roy Eldridge, then moving on into Charlie Parker, which was years worth of study. And he also made me a complete improvisational musician. He gave me a lot of study tools, learning the scales and the chords, composing solos, composing motifs that you change around, just like in classical music. You do it one way, a phrase one way, then you turn it upside down, then you turn it backwards, and you use these phrases through chord progressions. And he really gave me a firm grounding in all the harmonic and rhythmic structures of jazz, which was incredible.
Could I ask you to sing a harmonic exercise that he taught you?
Sure. One of the things he did in my first lesson, which I still use with my students, is he gave me a way to learn a song. Step one, learn the melody. So, for example, I've Got Rhythm. Just you have to be able to sing the melody with the metronome and nothing else. So that's your first lesson. Ba 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 da, ba 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 da. Ba 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 da ba di 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 da, etc. The second lesson is sing the roots of the chords in time. So the root is the bottom note of each chord. So for I Got Rhythm, it's ba da 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 da. Then you would sing 1, 3, 5, and 7 of each chord, but I'm going to have to do it slower. So, ba 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 do 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 do. That's in root position. Are you still with me?
Yeah, I am. I am.
Then you improvise with those chord tones, which. So instead of going da 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 da, you might go da 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 ba 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 ba. You fool around with those four notes on each chord, and then you by this time you really have a feeling in your body of what the harmony is. Then you go on to the scales and improvisation with the scales.
I saw a concert that you gave, this was years ago, sometime in the early or mid-80s, and I think it was exclusively scat singing. Did you go through a period of kind of abandoning the standards and going right to the improvisation?
Yes, and when I was studying with Warren, because he was very deeply into the improvisation, and that's what was attractive to me, and for years I was scatting. I was singing the melody, yeah, singing it nicely, but it was only just to get through it to get to the improvisation, you know. And this was in the early years. But over the last, gosh, about 6 or 7 years, I've really, really devoted myself to attaching emotionally to every lyric that I sing. And I threw out about half my repertoire because I realized that I had no feelings about the songs, although I liked them musically.
Hmm.
So, yeah, you're right. I did go through that of being, because it's really easy for me to be in the music and in the improvisation, and that's my natural bent. But now I'm enjoying so much, you know, experiencing the songs emotionally and being able to bring some feeling to the audience.
Judy Nemac's latest album is Heart's Desire on Stash Records. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Terry, as you know, President Bush has been raising his voice in complaint about Governor Clinton's draft record, his anti-war activities as a student, and a trip to the Soviet Union as a student. We'll be asking editorial writers what they think this all means and what they're writing. We have a report on the Venus probe, which lasted for many years more than it was supposed to, but finally seems to be falling into the planet, so goodbye to the Venus probe. And then we'll have a piece on fundraising in California. Democrats and women are raising a lot of money in California this year.
Thanks, Linda. Then and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Tonight on most public television stations, Great Performances presents its 20th anniversary special. TV critic David Bianculli has one complaint about it, but only one.
Here's the complaint. According to my TV calendar, Great Performances won't be 20 years old until 1994. Apparently, executive producer Jacques Venza is extending the show's birthday to include the series Theater in America, which came first and led directly to Great Performances. But that's it for the complaints. In fact, I would have been happy if Great Performances had done the expected and presented a retrospective look at its best stuff of the last 20 years, or 18 years, or whatever. After all, we're talking about Brideshead Revisited and Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, and Pavarotti and Baryshnikov, and Bernstein and Horowitz, and tons of others. But Great Performances is celebrating its anniversary in a way that's very different and very daring. It's gone out and commissioned original short works from some old friends, and collected them in a 90-minute sampler of music, dance, drama, and comedy. There's a rich variety of stuff here, from a mini-musical by Cy Coleman to a three-act mini-play by Wendy Wasserstein, from the choreography of Peter Martins to the hip-hop steps of the Rhythm Technicians. One of my favorites is Zoetrope, a playful dance duet with Mikhail Baryshnikov and Twyla Tharp. It's directed by Annie Leibovitz, who films them beautifully, and who allows their comments about dance to play on the soundtrack as they dance.
Cats are generally conceded as the great dancers. Cats are the ones who seem to have the quickest kind of reflexes and the best elevation and who seem to have the most mobility and who seem to be the bitchiest creatures.
The other total standout is The Last Mile, a self-contained comedy drama written by Terrence McNally. It's a behind-the-scenes look at a soprano's first featured appearance at the Met in Tosca. Bernadette Peters is the diva-in-waiting, Nathan Lane from Guys and Dolls is the stage manager, Bill Irwin is the orchestra conductor, and Paul Sorvino is the tenor. McNally's script is wickedly funny and completely credible, and every performance is terrific. Lane, as the stage manager, steals The Last Mile with his opening entrance.
Tonight's opera is Tosca, so nobody break into Boris Godunov or Faust, okay? It confuses the audience, not to mention our maestro.
Then Irwin, as the conductor, steals it from Lane, and then Peters steals it from him, and then Sorvino, with an operatic voice so strong it's funny, steals it from her.
I've got Johnny Carson for a stage manager. Remind me to laugh, ha-ha. All right, that's enough. Shut up. Let's do it.
To make a debut with the Metropolitan Opera. Who do you think you are, Missy? The arrogance, the presumption, the chutzpah, the nerve, the gall, the...
Hi. I'm your tenor for the evening, in case you hadn't guessed.
The Last Mile is a total delight, an all-star case of grand theft, and a four-star case of grand TV writing. This whole Great Performances special, in fact, is a pretty grand affair. Here's hoping for another 20 years. Or 18. Or whatever.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post and author of Teleliteracy, Taking Television Seriously. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Joan Tuohy, Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Sue Weinstein and Sue Spolin, research assistants from Penny Nelson. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the presidential campaign and the African-American vote. We'll talk with Ron Walters, the author of Black Presidential Politics in America. He's advised the Congressional Black Caucus and was deputy campaign manager for Jesse Jackson. We'll also get his reaction to the first presidential debate of this campaign. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.